offer my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet, and I welcome you, dear listeners, to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, and it gives me great pleasure to join you all again on this week's episode. The last week we went through only one verse, and that one verse was a very, very important one. And there is so much to say about that one verse, the 22nd verse of the 9th chapter, that I have not yet completed all that Swami has said about it. So much of today's episode 2 will be a continuation of that particular verse. And of course, we'll see if we can go ahead a little after that. But before I started the discussion on that verse, we started the episode last week with a few passages from the Gita Vahini itself. When I was reading them out, of course, I didn't tell you precisely why I was reading those passages out, but these were actually the writings of Swami that was leading up to the 22nd verse. The essence of what Swami had written in those passages that I shared with all of you is that the Bhagavad Gita as a text is not something that is to be worshipped or memorized. It is not something to be lectured upon. It is not something to be propagated through various forms of media. But it is meant to be practiced. That is why when we did the curtain raiser episode, the first episode of this series, I had mentioned this, that the Bhagavad Gita is part of the Prasthana Trayi, the three important texts. And among the other texts, it is called Sadhana Prasthana, which means that important spiritual text that is meant for practice, that is meant for directly applying in one's life. And Swami explained that in very, very emphatic terms. Swami had said that, forget about the 700 verses of the Bhagavad Gita. Even if you take one verse and if you're able to practice it, it is more worthwhile than you knowing by memory all the other verses or being able to quote verbatim from any spiritual text. Having said that, Swami said, there is one shloka which is like the crest jewel of the entire Gita. And Swami went on to say that if this one verse is followed in practice, the entire Gita can be understood. And that's how Swami led up to this 22nd verse of the 9th chapter. The verse itself is Ananyas Chintayanto Mam Ye Janaha Paryupasate. Without thoughts of no other, those people who worship me, Tesham Nityabhiyuktanam Yoga Kshemam Vahamyaham. For a person who is thus focused, I carry the responsibility of their Yoga Kshema. It's a shloka where Krishna gives a very, very important promise, but there is a proviso, and that is Ananyas Chintana, right? Ananyas Chintana is one of the preconditions that Krishna places for the fulfillment of this promise. We discussed this Ananyas Chintana, and Swami explained how this and what Krishna states in the next line, Nitya Abhiyuktanam, who are constantly focused, go hand in hand. Swami gives the example of the Gopikas. Swami says their mind was completely absorbed in Krishna out of their immense love. And that is the first hint that we actually have that this is not really a sadhana. This is not something that can be really practiced, but this is something that you can practice towards, right? You need to do some sadhana to reach to the state, because this in itself is an expression of a state of devotion, right? We will come back to this shortly because that's going to be an important part of the discussion today. Another interpretation of this word ananya that Swami gives sometimes, and I did not have the time to touch upon that last week, is a devotee who does not think of the Lord as anya, as another person, as a stranger, as somebody who is superior, who needs to be kept at a distance, right? Swami would often say this. The Lord comes down as an avatar not to be you know, caged up or put up in a museum. And that's why Swami would say, I've come as a normal human being so that you relate to me. You think of me as your own, right? So that also means anya. Anya, ananyas chinta means the one who is able to think of the Lord and worship Him without the feeling that He is a stranger, anya. What it means is you think of the Lord as belonging to you, right? There is no feeling of distance. The first line also can be spoken of as, if you take this meaning, those that think of me as their own and worship me. This attitude of mindness is what we refer to as mamatvam. And this mamatvam towards God is what becomes mamata or love. Swami says this in one of his vahinis, that first there is an affection filled with attachment that is turned towards God. Anurakti, Swami says, that is the first feeling that you turn towards God, my Swami, right? And Swami says that that is like a flower which then becomes the fruit, which is bhakti. And when this fruit ripens, it becomes jnana. So that feeling of ananya, God is not different from me, distant from me, He is not a stranger to me, is a very important attitude in this process. Coming to yogakshema, we saw the very many versions and interpretations of this. We'll see a few more today. The most straightforward is welfare. Yogakshema means someone's welfare. Whatever we seek in life, what we feel will give us peace, which inspires us to pray, can be called yoga. That which I want to have a union with. I want a new car. I want a new home. I want this new job, right? It is not mine. I want to have it. So everything that you want to have gets covered under this word yoga. And kshema is something that is already in your possession, which you want to preserve it. You have good health, you want to preserve that health. You have friends and family, you look for their security and safety, right? So that is kshema. Yoga is what I want to achieve. Kshema is to protect and preserve what I already have. So together it means one's welfare. So whatever we seek as or what we desire falls under these two categories. The second interpretation is acquisition of something that is desirable, which is yoga, and preservation of what that is thus acquired. I want to achieve something, and having achieved it, I want to preserve it. So yoga and kshema of that yoga is yoga kshema. That is another interpretation. If you really look at it, that also adds to what we define under desires. The third interpretation that Swami gives is, kshema is that which can be attained by one's own effort or the fruits of one's own actions, and yoga represents that which cannot be attained by human effort. And Krishna promises that He will bless the devotee with both. Why should Krishna promise to give me something that is already mine? Kshema is something that is already mine or that can be achieved by my own action. Why is Krishna promising that He will give you what is already yours? Swami gave an example in which we saw how even that which is rightfully ours, when God takes charge of our life, He ensures that what is rightfully ours comes to us in the most appropriate time. When I'm already filled with riches, somebody comes back and gives me something that he owes me or she owes me, probably I will not value it. But at a time when I am in need, if that which belongs to me comes back to me, I would be even more grateful, right? And this is an experience of so many devotees, right? At the right time, Swami would come and do the right thing. A couple of years back, I met a family of a person who had a tremendous amount of problems in life, especially financial problems, because whatever work he would take up, whatever business he would take up, everything would fail. And I think close to 15 to 20 years, he just could not do anything. Whatever he would take up would lead to a loss and end up using up all the money that the family and his ancestors had saved. So it came to a point that he was best advised to just keep quiet and not do anything, right? So literally a family that had no earnings for a very, very long period of time. And of course, the father and the son were telling me about this problem, and they said, this is how it has been happening, and we don't know when this is going to end. We have a lot of debts to settle. And when I spoke to that father told me, I mean, he did not seem restless. He did not seem despondent, because he said, sir, my experience is that Swami knows what I require when, and he does it at the precise time. And he went on to say, I have no earnings. I have not been earning any money for so many years. Yet, my three children, one is a doctor, the other two are my two daughters, have finished their postgraduate studies. And I looked at him and said, how was that even possible? He said, it's purely because of Swami. Because Swami just ensured that whenever there was a need, somebody would come and step in. And Swami ensured that that need was settled through them, right? And he said, we went to someone's marriage, and there somebody came and asked me, would you like to give your daughter to us, to our house in marriage? And that's how my first daughter's wedding just got settled. During the wedding of my first daughter, another family came and asked for my second daughter, and her daughter, her wedding got settled. And he said, I really didn't have to do anything. Swami ensured that every time there was a need, it was taken care of. This is what is the experience of so many devotees when Krishna says, you dedicate yourself to me and yoga kshema of yours and people whom you say are yours, it all depends on me, right? So what is already ours also will come at the precise time when he takes charge of our life. How does one practice this ananya bhakti, right? Ananya bhakti means having devotion without thinking of any other. One way we discussed last time was to keep the Lord as the only goal. Our mind is given constantly to anya chintana, right? Constantly thinking and worrying about so many things, worrying about, I mean, legitimate worries. You want to make ends meet, you want to take care of your children, you want to provide for your family, you're worried about your health. These are all normal, regular chintanas that one goes through. If we were to sublimate all of these worries and thoughts in one worry or one ambition, that is, how do I please Swami through my actions? What should I do at this moment, at this situation, to ensure that it would please Swami or it would be approved by Swami, right? If one were to keep that as one's goal in life, there will be no ananya chintana, right? So that is one way by which this ananya chinta can be achieved, where you do not have multiple goals to reach, you do not have multiple masters to please, right? And the assurance is, I will take care of the rest. Because Krishna is not saying, become beggars, live on the streets, give up all your possessions and just become vairagis. That's not what Krishna is saying. Instead, he's saying, other than running after all these needs and desires, what you want to attain and what you want to secure in your life, what you refer to as yoga and kshema, constantly getting bogged down by these thoughts, try only to please me. Try only to love me. What makes you think that I will not give you what you need? Right? As we saw last week, even the physical mother of a single child takes care of the needs of the child without being asked. And we are talking of the Lord, whose love in our poor mathematics can be called as the love of 1,000 mothers. Truly speaking, it is much, much more than that, isn't it? What makes us think that he will not provide for us, right? So that is one of the things. We'll come back to some of these things again. But these are some of the points that I covered last week. And I will take it forward from there. Talking about yoga kshema, let me read a passage from the Gita Vahini and we'll take it forward from there. Again, from the same chapter 19 of the Gita Vahini, very, very beautiful and profound chapter. I'm going to read out another passage from there. Swami says, and I quote, "The Lord has given the assurance, I shall bear the burden of your welfare, here and hereafter. Yoga kshemam vahamyaham. He has undertaken this task voluntarily, but for mortals and aspirants to benefit from this, they have to live as ordained. They have to adhere to the lines laid down. When they feel that they are not so helped, they have only to examine their own lives and discover how far they have kept up the commands of God regarding the regulation of life. They fail to examine this. They do not consider the past and future. They complain about the grief of the moment, not knowing that it is caused by neglect in the past and ignorance of the future. This is the root of their suffering." End of quote. So when we have full faith in this assurance, the way we look at life will completely change. If we seriously feel at any point in our life that Swami is not fulfilling a need, then we will look at our own mind and we will ask, is there any flaw in the faith? Or if a need is not fulfilled, we will have the full confidence and we'll look at it and say that maybe it's not a need at all. Because if it was a need, Swami has said, yoga kshemam vahamyaham, he will fulfill it. If he has not fulfilled it, then I don't need it. Right? So Swami is saying that the attitude will be skewed, or the approach to life will be skewed by this attitude, where the devotee says that I'm going to look at my entire life through this prism of this promise that God has given. Yoga kshemam vahamyaham. And the way to achieve that is to live with that confidence, right? And that is what makes this shloka practicable. I said that it cannot be practiced because it's an expression of a state of devotion one reaches, but it can also be practiced if we are able to remind ourselves of this and exude that confidence, right? So that is what makes this verse practicable too. So these were the many points that we covered last week. So we are talking here only about worldly welfare. At least so far, we have only spoken about yoga and shema as worldly welfare, worldly needs. But is that all that this shloka stands for? This shloka, as I said, is special because it applies to the mundane as much as it applies to the profound. And as we have seen through the Gita till this point, Krishna does not deviate from the profound at all. What he says does apply to the mundane too, because what applies to this supreme goal of life certainly can be applied to mundane life too. You know, if that can be taken care of, what is there in this, right? In that sense, it can be applied to mundane life, but whatever Krishna says has to be taken in the highest sense too. In a discourse that Swami delivered on 16th of October 1964, Swami had this to say, and I quote, "Yoga kshemam vahamyaham. This does not mean that the Lord will ensure for you sukham and santosha, happiness and joy, but it means that the Lord will endow you with steady, unshakable peace, inner equanimity. Yoga means the acquisition of that which you do not have, and kshema means the preservation of that which you have acquired. So the assurance means that the Lord will ensure that you acquire the shanti that you do not have and create conditions under which you can preserve that shanti. For the greatest happiness is shanti, what is inner peace. How do you get it? By knowing that you are the Atma, which has no birth or death, no joy or grief, no up, no down." End of quote. Swami gives a completely different twist to the shloka by stating that what Krishna promises that the Lord will help you in securing and preserving is not worldly comfort and happiness, but that elusive inner peace. But if you really look at it, even in a physical welfare, without our knowledge, whether we acknowledge it or not, we are only seeking this peace and tranquility. It is the first illusion that we think we are thinking. The first illusion that we entertain is we thinking that we are seeking these objects. And Swami says in that quote, God doesn't merely give you that peace through taking care of your welfare, but leads you on to the supreme peace that comes with the understanding of the Atma, right? So even when we are seeking objects, even when we are seeking, as we have said, spoken about this many times before, I'm having a disease, I'm having a problem in my body. Why am I seeking relief? I'm seeking relief because that gives me peace. And the lack of that peace is only referred to as dis-ease, right? So we are in pursuit of peace. The moment we recognize this, we acknowledge this, our approach to life changes, right? So when Krishna says yogakshemam mahamyam, he might at some points in life give us that peace by taking care of worldly things. But from his point of view, from the divine's point of view, he is only ensuring that we are given peace that we require at different stages in life, right? And through that process, he's leading us to a state where this peace can never be taken away. Now, let me talk about something that I have discussed before. I had spoken about this when we were going through the sixth chapter itself. And we will see how what Krishna said there in the context of dhyana or meditation, because the sixth chapter was dhyana yoga, is related to what Krishna is saying here with regards to devotion. In fact, even in that portion, Krishna did speak about devotion pretty suddenly, right? When he was talking about meditation and focusing on that one form or name or whatever it is, suddenly Swami spoke about devotion. The shlokas I'm referring to are shlokas 29, 30 and 31 of the sixth chapter. If I'm not wrong, it was somewhere around the 86th, 87th episode of the Gita series, in case you want to go back and listen to that. That's the reference for you. But these were the shlokas that we discussed, 29, 30 and 31 of the sixth chapter. When we were discussing that portion, I had spoken about the three stages of devotion. Samanya Bhakti, Ekanta Bhakti and Ananya Bhakti. So we had spoken about the three forms of devotion. Samanya Bhakti, Ekanta Bhakti and Ananya Bhakti. Samanya Bhakti means ordinary devotion, and Swami says it is also called Bhautika Bhakti or worldly devotion. And he said that all forms of worship, bhajan, puja, japa, going on pilgrimages, building temples, attending satsangs, all come under this Bhautika Bhakti or Samanya Bhakti, ordinary form of devotion. These have a role in our spiritual journey, and that is, they are all meant to purify the mind. The next stage is Ekanta Bhakti. Ekanta means solitude. So the direct translation of this phrase, Ekanta Bhakti, is devotion that is practiced in solitude. But that doesn't define the stage of devotion. Just sitting alone in the puja room or going off to some hilltop in some secluded place and practicing devotion doesn't become Ekanta Bhakti. What is achieved through this sadhana of performing any form of worship or any form of spiritual practice in solitude, what is achieved can be referred to as Ekanta Bhakti. And this Ekanta Bhakti leads to Ananya Bhakti, something that we are talking about in this portion of the Gita. What is this Ananya Bhakti? And from this, we can also derive the other interpretation of the term Ananyas Chintayanta, right? There's a very beautiful discourse where Swami speaks about these stages, when I was doing the sixth chapter, I had suggested this discourse for further reading. I'm repeating it here. It was a discourse that Swami delivered on the 23rd of January 1982. The discourse itself is entitled Bhakti Stage by Stage. And it was in this discourse that Swami explains that what this three stages of bhakti, Samanya, Ekanta and Ananya, is meant to bring to us, or what we are meant to achieve through these three stages. Swami says in that discourse that God is present in all beings as love. Swami says that's why I refer to all of you as Prema Swarupalara, the embodiments of divine Prema or divine love. So Swami says God is present in all beings as love, but it is covered by desires. And when this love is expressed, because it is covered by desires, it has the flaws of attachment, sometimes of jealousy, of expectations, so on and so forth. But it is the same love, right? Many times Swami has said this. Many devotees have asked Swami, how do we get pure love? And Swami would say that you already have it. You know, there is no distinction or difference between Swami's love and your love. The only problem is it is now encased or encaged in your desires and your ideas of body consciousness, right? So if we really observe, in the bottom of all these emotions, there is actually love. Swami, in fact, in one of the discourses, he says, even your desire for a worldly object comes because of this principle of love that is inside you. But by the time it expresses in the form of desire, in the form of attachment, jealousy, and so on. So there is this fundamental divine love in everyone. And the process of spirituality is nothing but trying to reach out to and releasing this love from within. And this involves three steps, which are described as the three stages of bhakti: Samanya, Ekanta, and Ananya Bhakti. The first one, Samanya or Bhautika, Swami says, involves the physical body and the mind. Everything that is within the physical realm, all kinds of pujas that we do, all kinds of worship that we perform, be it going to a church and singing in carols, or going to a temple and doing an archana, or sitting in your puja room and doing japa, all of that involves you using your physical apparatus and the mind, right? So Swami says that these all involve the body and the mind, and all Samanya Bhakti, Swami says even the Navavida Bhakti, what we talk of as Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu Smaranam, Padasevanam, all of that come under Samanya Bhakti, and their role is precisely to purify the mind and the body, right? They are meant solely for this purificatory process. The next stage is when you try to go beyond the physical, look beyond what is obvious to the physical eye. And for that, the tool that you have is your own body and the mind, right? And in Ekanta Bhakti, the steady and pure mind is slowly turned inwards. So now if you look at it, all that Krishna spoke in the sixth chapter under Dhyana Yoga comes under Ekanta Bhakti, the practice of trying to go beyond the physical, the sadhana that you perform in solitude, right? Why solitude? Why Ekantam? Because in solitude, you can control things around you. Much of what we discussed during the Dhyana Yoga, you can ensure that there is no noise around you. You can ensure that you're sitting in a comfortable position and posture. You can ensure that there is nothing disturbing you. There are no insects and ants around you. And in fact, Swami goes on to say that this is Sukha Dhyana. You ensure that all the controllables around you are controlled so that you can focus. And what is the goal of this focus? As Swami had said, the idea of Dhyana itself is to transcend the physical, where you try to focus your mind within, and the process involves breath control, a certain kind of posturing. In fact, in that discourse that I made a reference to, there is a big portion where Swami speaks about this. Dhyana yoga is covered when Swami speaks about ekanta bhakti, the way you sit, the way you observe your breath, the way you what you think about, all of that comes under this. And for this ekanta bhakti, it is helpful to focus on one name and form. Again, something that we discussed. The whole idea of dhyana or ekanta bhakti is to focus the mind, and it is easier to focus the mind when there is one name and form that you look at. So in this stage, though the devotee is aware that the Lord has many names and forms, she or he chooses one form and name and concentrates the mind and sublimates it through this process of sitting in solitude and focusing the mind. That is why ekanta bhakti is also described as that devotion where the devotee is completely dedicated to one form. So ekanta bhakti cannot be defined as focusing on one form, completely cannot be defined as sitting in solitude and doing sadhana completely. But both together form an important component of what is referred to as ekanta bhakti. And this second stage of ekanta bhakti must lead to ananya bhakti, where the devotee recognizes that this entire manifest universe is suffused with the Lord. In the various forms, individuals, objects, nature, everything is only an illusion that is hiding the Lord. This attitude is called ananya bhakti. I don't see any other in this world. Ananya. Ananya means no other. So ananya bhakti is that stage where the devotee is not able to see anything other than the Lord, because that realization that this entire cosmos is suffused with the Lord has taken firm root in the mind. And ananya chintana is the ability to see everything as not being different from the Lord. Swami explains this in the following quote, and this is from a discourse that Swami delivered in 24th of May 1991. Swami says, very beautifully and crisply, Swami summarizes this whole thing. Swami says, in the Gita, Shri Krishna declared, yoga kshemam vahamyaham. In ordinary parlance, yoga kshemam is understood as referring to the well-being derived from the family, possessions and pleasurable objects. To apply the term yoga to such mundane benefits is totally inappropriate. Yoga is the state that is realized by one who, born as a human being, engages himself in various spiritual exercises to experience the transcendental divinity. Yoga thus means the attainment of that divinity which is not easily attainable. It refers to the envisioning of that which is beyond the physical vision. Yoga means experiencing that divine which is not visible to the eye or audible to the ear, which is beyond the reach of the mind and the heart, through a process of spiritual discipline. It is the process of making manifest in one's experience the unmanifested divinity. Kshema means safeguarding the yogic experience which has been realized through spiritual efforts. Yoga kshema, therefore, means acquiring the experience of the transcendental divine and endeavoring to preserve it. End of quote. So in the ultimate sense, God is here to lead us to that experience of the Supreme. And when he says yoga kshemam vahamyaham, he doesn't say that I'm going to preserve your body, I'm going to preserve your possessions, I'm going to preserve those who are related to you, I'm going to help them win their ambitions. Even when Swami appears to be doing that, as students, when we have seen, even when he was taking care of our health, even when he was taking care of our needs, of our families, what he was doing is, he was leading us to this experience, whether we acknowledge it or not, whether we are aware of it or not. Even when Krishna was speaking about meditation, which is as I just mentioned, is a very important component of this Ekanta Bhakti. The entire meditation process falls in this stage of Ekanta Bhakti. And at that point, Krishna had said, Yo mam pashyati sarvatra, sarvam cha mahi pashyati, tasyaham na pranashyami, sacha me na pranashyati. Very beautiful words. He says, He who sees me everywhere and sees everything in me, he never becomes separated from me, nor do I become separated from him. This is Ananya Bhakti. This is Ananya Chintana. The devotee sees the Lord everywhere, and such a devotee can never be separated from the Lord. Today we're all sitting here, it's the month of April, and it is difficult not to think about the events of 2011 April, right? And even today we sit here and we think, oh, Swami, you left us, and Swami, you're not physically here, Swami, we're not able to see you. That shows the stage of devotion we are in, right? Because we have not reached that state of Ananya Bhakti. Because if we were there, we will say, Mam, you know, as Krishna said, Yo Mam Pashyati Sarvatra. You will be among, you'll be counted amongst those people whom Krishna says, those who see me everywhere, those who see everything in me. How can they ever say that God is distant from me? Or how can they ever say that they are distant from God? Right? That's precisely what Krishna is saying. And Krishna takes care of yoga kshema, the attainment of the Lord, that yoga, and the non-separation from the Lord thereafter, that kshema. As you all know, most of our listeners must be aware, we are going through this wonderful book called Conversations with Bhagwan Shri Sathya Sai Baba as part of the afternoon satsang program, the other segment that I'm part of. Dr. Hislop was a very deeply spiritual man, and he had practiced intense sadhana even before coming to Swami. And in that book, on many occasions, he asks about various meditation techniques. He asks about pranayama and so on, and some of these yogic practices. And you will find that almost every time Swami brings him back to devotion, Swami keeps saying that, oh, all that is easy to achieve when you have love for God. Oh, all that is fine, but you should have love for God. Oh, all that is okay, but you should be able to think of God lovingly. Swami keeps bringing him back to that point again and again. In fact, in one exchange, Swami tells him this. Swami says, all of these, like Hatha Yoga and so on, are like exams. You study and pass the exam, and then you feel confident and proud. It is like going to college. There are eight principal stages, and you work and reach each one. But they are necessary only if you go to college. For the one who has completely surrendered to God and whose heart is filled with love for God, these college courses are not needed and have no meaning and are quite unnecessary. Swami very, very clearly says that, you know, yes, if you enroll yourself in a college, there will be many semesters, you'll have to clear each one of them, there'll be internals, externals, and all of that. All of these yogic practices are like that. But Swami says the one who is surrendered to God, whose heart is filled with love for God, doesn't have to go through these courses, because yoga kshemam vahamyaham, right? In reply to another such exchange in the same book, this was a question that was asked by another devotee about surrendering to God. And Swami says there, he says, surrender to God is a state beyond man's will. Surrender is when the doer, the deed, and the object are all God. It cannot be forced. It comes naturally to a heart filled with love for God. The point is, I made this last week too, this journey from individuality to divinity, from vyaktitva to Sakshatkara, is a long and complex one. It pans over many, many lifetimes, many stages, right? But to have love for God is something remarkably special. And I don't think however much I explain this and talk about it over and over again, I'm going to do justice to it. Just going through Swami's words, you know, you get a hint as to there's something special about bhakti, something special about loving God. I can't explain it. I cannot put it across intelligibly, but I know it intuitively. There's something in loving God, something in feeling love for God. And it is even more impossible to say what has brought us to this moment when we are standing here and we, in some corner of our heart, feel love for Swami. What did we do? What have we done here that today we are here and we are able to feel this love for Swami, right? The love that we feel for Swami may be like the size of a tiny seed, the size of a mustard seed. That's all is the measure of the love that we have for Swami, probably. But it's like the seed, what you see in the famous fairy tale, Jack and the Beanstalk, right? This is something like a small seed. It looks silly and simple like any other seed, but when it is fostered, it can grow into this giant stalk which can take you right to heaven. So if you sense that love somewhere in the corner of the heart, foster it, preserve it, make it grow, protect it, right? Do whatever it takes to make it grow. Because this love for God itself is a boon that has been got after so much sadhana, right? That's why Swami says that surrender to God is not something that comes with human will. It's not that I will to surrender to Swami. It doesn't work that way. You can only try to develop love for Swami. You can have that love. You can foster that love. And surrender to God will be a blessing from Swami, right? This love for God itself is such a boon. There's one, again, going back to Dr. Hislop's conversations. At one point, he asks Swami this. Swami, can this love be really developed? You keep saying that you should have love for God, you should have this kind of devotion towards God, but can it really be developed? Either one has it or one doesn't have it, right? Maybe you look at people around, there's some people who love Swami, there's some people who don't. It's either there or it isn't there. Can anything be done about it? Swami then turns to Dr. Hislop and asks him, do you feel that you love Swami? And without a pause, he says, yes, Swami, I think I do feel I love Swami. Then Swami asks him, how did you get that love? He has no answer to give, and Swami says, it is because of the sadhana that you have done over many, many lifetimes. So today, if we feel any bit of love for Swami, be absolutely sure it has not come by accident. Similarly, having that love, it will not grow by itself, right? When Swami says, you know, whatever sadhana that you've done in your many lifetimes, today you feel a sense of love for God, which means that love for God will not grow on its own. It has to be nourished by sadhana, isn't it? So that is the point that Swami makes in that same discourse on the various stages of bhakti. Swami makes a very beautiful point. He says, when Parikshit was about to die in 7 days, Sukha Maharishi comes to him. And what does this Sukha Maharishi do? He gives him a discourse on Bhagavatam, stories of love between the Lord and his devotees. This Sukha Maharishi is supposed to be a great renunciant, a vairagi of the highest order. The legend goes that he renounces the entire world as soon as he is born. That's how detached he is. Such a great jnani says that the gopis are the highest devotees. And the Bhagavatam records that even as he starts speaking about these devotees, the gopikas, this great jnani who has no attachment to the world, he starts shedding tears, moved by that love. Swami says that that is because they represented Ananya Bhakti. And Swami ends that discourse with a very important instruction to all of us. Swami says, members of the Satya Sai organization should attempt to follow the right path and raise their own spiritual effort to the level of Ananya Bhakti. The world today is in a very bad state. The situation can improve only through Astika, who are believers in divinity. They should become Prema Swarupas or embodiments of love, and by their sadhana, backed by their patience, forbearance and compassion, play their role in serving society and contributing to the betterment of the world. End of quote. So this ability to be able to love God is the greatest of gifts that Swami has given each one of us, right? Some of us might have had the opportunity to be a student. Some of us might have had the opportunity to receive gifts from him, to be spoken to by him. Yes, all of these are special in their own way, but the greatest gift that Swami has given to each one of us, whether you have seen Swami or not, and it is that ability to feel love for him. You are listening to this program not because you like Radio Sai, not because you're fond of me, or not because you're fond of any of the hosts that come here. You are listening to any of our broadcasts because you love Swami, right? And if that love is there, you've already been blessed. Now I think it is up to each one of us to raise to this Ananya Bhakti, as Swami says. And a sign of that is the faith that my Swami will take care of my yogic shema. There's nothing to be worried about, isn't it? He is the Yogeshwara himself. He's taking care of the functioning of this entire cosmos. Cannot this Yogeshwara take care of my yogic shema? And that faith must manifest as righteousness. I should be able to fearlessly do what is right, because I don't have to worry about my welfare. And I should be able to fearlessly do what is right, because I serve only one master. And my life goal is to please this master in everything that I do. One last point about this shloka before we move ahead is, this, as I said, is also a description of a jnani, right? A jnani is one who is firmly established in that. And this is, again, we've seen this earlier also when Krishna is talking about a karma yogi. He is actually describing a jnani in terms of a karma yogi. In that sense, if you really look at it, the shloka is a description of a jnani. The jnani who believes that Ananya Chintana is... There's another very beautiful discourse, I don't have the reference to it right away, where Swami says, a jnani is one who's reached that state where he feels that everything is God. So where is the question of Ananya Chintana? Whatever he thinks of, he's thinking of God. He believes it, right? The jnani is in that state. So this shloka, as I said, can be looked at as a description of a jnani too. But at the same time, it is a shloka that can be practiced, that should be practiced, and that is a litmus for each one of us. If we lack the confidence in this statement, yoga kshemam vahamyaham, I think we'll have to go back and fix the bhakti that we have towards Swami. If at any time there is a fear, there is a concern, there is a feeling of desperation about the future, which means, as Swami said in that portion that I read out from the Gita, you have to look back at your own self and say, where is my Ananya Bhakti faltering? Right? So this is also a shloka. It is like a prism through which you have to look at your entire life when you qualify yourself as a devotee. So that's the 22nd verse. The next two verses are important in a sense that it'll again bring us back to the context in which the 22nd verse itself appears. So we will listen to the 23rd verse in Brother Shyam's voice, and then we'll discuss about it.
Yepyanya devata bhakta yajante shraddhayanvita tepi mameva kaunteya yajantya vidhi purvakam.
Even those who worship the lesser powers, if they do so with faith, they thereby worship me, though not in the right way. So that's the 23rd verse of the 9th chapter. In this shloka and the next one too, Krishna contrasts the 22nd shloka and makes a point that he had made earlier too in the 7th chapter. Krishna had said in the 7th chapter that there are two types of devotees, right? Worshippers of Vasudeva and worshippers of other deities. And Vasudeva doesn't mean Krishna, right? Vasudeva is a name that is given to Krishna because he is the son of Vasudeva. But when Krishna says worshippers of Vasudeva, we had seen that in Swami's writings too. Worshippers of those who believe, worship the God with the faith that there is one Supreme Lord, and that Supreme Lord is the indweller of all beings. Vasudeva means he who is the indweller of all that there is. There in the 7th chapter, Krishna had made a very beautiful point. He had said, Yo yo yam yam tanum bhaktaha shraddhayarchitum icchati tasya tasya chalam shraddham tameva vidadham yaham. Whichever form of deity any devotee wants to worship with faith, that very firm faith of his or hers I strengthen. When you worship any other deity, that faith with which you worship it, I strengthen it. And how does that faith be strengthened? Because the Lord responds to prayers even when it is addressed to those different deities. And then he goes on to say, through that faith which has been thus strengthened, he gets what he desires. The devotee gets what he desires, but the one who blesses, the one who is enabling this process, is the same Lord. And in that portion, Krishna mentions, from this discussion, right, in the 7th chapter, then he goes on to speak about artha, artati, jignasu and all of that. It can be seen that when Krishna said in the previous verse, ananyas chintayantaha, in the context of what is being said in this portion of the Gita, one doesn't get distracted by other thoughts and desires. Because here in this shloka he says, ye api anya devataha bhaktaha, even those who are devoted to other gods. So anya chintana is contrasted with anya devata bhakti. If you believe that there are many devatas to please and placate, you will not be a nitya yukta, one with steady focus, right? When you have many goals, there is going to be no focus. And as Krishna had explained it in that chapter, in the 7th chapter, this worshipping of many devatas is directly linked to having many desires. Krishna states in this verse, ye api anya devataha bhaktaha, even those who are devoted to other gods, yajante, perform worship, shraddhaya anvitaha, endowed with faith. Even to worship different deities for different needs calls for shraddha. You, without shraddha, without faith, you cannot perform any worship, right? Without faith, there is no puja at all. In fact, without faith, there is no karma at all. As we have discussed when we were doing karma yoga, I will not even brush my teeth if I do not have the faith that this act of brushing my teeth is good for me, right? There is faith in that. So every karma is backed by faith. Worship is also a form of karma, and worship also needs to be backed by faith. So anyate yajante shraddhaya anvitaha. All these worships are also performed because they are endowed with faith. Te api, they too, mam eva yajanti kaunteya, worship me alone, O Arjuna. when Krishna says, I am in all, when he has made it clear that he is the Adidaiva, the deity in all the deities, is not all worship being offered to him? Then what is the problem in that? If everything is anyway being offered to him, what does it matter whether I worship the sun god today and the moon god tomorrow and then some other god day after? Anyway, everything is going to him. Why is such a fuss about worshipping many devatas and deities? Krishna says, Te api maam eva kaunteya yajanti avidhi purvakam. Avidhi purvakam. But by the wrong methods. Yes, they are worshipping me. Even when they are worshipping these deities, they are worshipping me. But avidhi purvakam. It reaches the same Lord, but the vidhi or the method is wrong. When I am a worshipper of devatas, it is an expression of specific needs and desires, which means I am saying what I need when I need it. Though the worship is eventually going to the same Lord, I am restricting the grace of the Supreme Lord by saying, I want this and that, and I want it at this time or at later. I'm restricting the flow of grace by saying that this is how I want it. But when there is surrender, as Krishna said in the previous verse, you are like an infant to the Lord. You become his complete responsibility. There is nothing to ask at all. And what is the problem with this? Krishna mentions that in the next shloka, something that he has been saying all along. I think we'll just have enough time to go through that next shloka because there's nothing much to explain other than the completion of this point that Krishna is making. So we'll listen to it and I'll give you a brief meaning after that.
Aham hi sarva yajnanam bhokta cha prabhureva cha natu mama bhijananti tatvenatashchyavantite.
I am the willing recipient of sacrifice and I am its true Lord. But these do not know me in truth and so they sink back. It is not in where the prayers reach finally, but with what faith that prayer is being made, right? That's why Krishna is making this point. That's why Krishna says here, Aham hi sarva yajnanam bhokta cha. And I am the bhokta, the final receiver of all the yajnas. Prabhureva cha. And also the Lord. As we've seen this was the theme before we went into the 22nd verse. Krishna was speaking about those that perform yajnas for a place in heaven, right? That's the context of the entire portion that we're going through. Those who perform yajnas with the desire to enter the realm of heavens. So Krishna continues in the same theme. He says, whatever yajna you may do, I am the bhokta, because I am the Lord of all worlds, Prabhu Revacha. Tu, but, na maam abhijananti tatvena. They do not know me in truth. Tatvena is a word we have come across many times. Knowing, abhijananti, is one thing. Abhijananti tatvena is a completely different thing. To know God and to know God in essence is completely different. So Krishna says that those that worship other deities or devatas who take up vows and perform these yajnas and pujas and I have to pour oil there, I have to light a lamp here, I have to go and tie this thing there. All these various devatas, those who worship, they have faith. Certainly they have faith, they have shraddha. And their prayers also reach only me, but they do not recognize my reality, tattva. And because of that, their worship is avidhi purvakam. It is not in the right vidhi, in the right method. And what happens because of that? Ataha, hence, chyavanti te, they fall back or sink. This is not like a curse that Krishna is giving. Oh, you will fall down eternal perdition. No, it's not in that sense that Krishna is saying this. Where do they fall? They fall back into the material world of coming and going. And that was the point that Krishna has been driving through this portion, isn't it? They fall back into this cycle. And the whole idea is to release oneself from the cycle of coming and going, isn't it? So the one who knows the Lord in Tattva will never have to ask for such things. And the process of worship is meant to take us to that state of understanding. Yes, whatever worship you make, to whomever it is addressed, it reaches the same Lord. But when this attitude that the Lord knows what is best for me, as Krishna said in the previous verse, starts stepping in, you do not have to go to different devatas and deities and present your case and make prayers to each one of them. You pray to the Supreme Lord directly, and the Supreme Lord will give you what is required. So I will end with that, dear listeners. We'll continue the 9th chapter when we meet next time, next week. Thank you for joining me, and I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's lotus feet. We can't thank Swami enough. We can't be grateful enough to Swami for giving us this opportunity to sit and think of Him, to love Him. And let's conclude with the prayer that every passing day, let this love for Swami keep growing and growing till it engulfs us. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishuv for the next segment at 12 p.m., 12 noon. I will join you with Sai Prakash for the continuation of the afternoon satsang. But till I meet you next week as part of the Gita series, keep safe, take care, Jai Sai Ram.